If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hi, I'm going to whisper some things to you now about Crunch chocolate bars. Because apparently this whispering thing is a thing that makes you feel things. It's saying something crunchy is coming in the candy wrapper language. Imagine your tongue hiking up those crispy, rocky ridges. Now, drum roll, please.
Wow, that's good. Crunchy, munchy chocolate doesn't whisper.
Turn up the fun with Crunch.
I was told by some people initially that I couldn't possibly write a successful show about Vikings because they were the other, because they were the people who came and broke into your house at night and raped and pillaged. And I said, well, you know, you think that's your cliche, but how about thinking about them as family people?
That was Michael Hirst talking to us about how he brings history to our screens.
Listening to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine. We're the UK's best-selling history magazine, available in print and several digital formats all over the world. Find out more at historyextra.com/subscribe or look out for us in your digital newsstand or app store.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast. I'm Rob Attar, the editor of BBC History Magazine. For today's episode, we've interviewed Michael Hirst, a producer and screenwriter whose work includes The Tudors, The Borgias, two films about Elizabeth, and the current smash hit history drama Vikings. He spoke to our deputy digital editor, Eleanor Evans, about his work on Vikings and creating history dramas more generally. And please do be aware that the interview does contain some plot spoilers for the Viking series.
I'm here in London with Michael Hirst, an award-winning screenwriter and producer who's written many hugely successful historical television dramas and films, from The Tudors and the Oscar-winning Elizabeth to Vikings. It's lovely to be talking with you, Michael.
Thank you very much.
So perhaps we can start by talking about one of your most successful shows, Vikings. And if we can talk a bit about what brought you to the Vikings, because you're obviously six seasons in now and a hugely successful show. But you've said that when you started writing it, people didn't necessarily think it was going to be that successful. So why do you think it has been such a success, and what brought you to them?
Many years ago, I was writing a film script about Alfred the Great, and Alfred the Great fought against the Vikings, in fact, fought against the Sons of Ragnar. And that's my first real immersion into the Vikings, and I did a lot of reading at that time, and was fascinated to discover that a lot of what I thought I knew about them was wrong. That I knew nothing about their attitude towards women, which was much more progressive than most other societies, that they were a democratic society, that their engineering skills, their boat-building skills were phenomenal. Lots of things that I hadn't known, because we are all brought up on clichés about the Vikings, that they're brutal, mindless savages. They were certainly, when they needed to be brutal, there's no question about that, but they weren't savages. So there is that thing that often works when you say to people you think you know about something, actually you don't know anything, and we're going to show you that you don't know anything. At another level, none of these shows, none of these television dramas will ever work unless you care about the characters. So I was told by some people initially that I couldn't possibly write a successful show about Vikings because they were the other, because they were the people who came and broke into your house at night and raped and pillaged. And I said, well, you know, you think that, that's your cliche, but how about thinking about them as family people? You know, that mothers and fathers love their children and husbands love their wives, and, you know, and that I'm going to tell the story of a family. Okay, but this family happens to be a Viking family. And our main Viking, at least at the start, Ragnar Lothbrok, is not interested at all in rape and pillage. He's interested in exploration. And the Vikings had the technology for that. They had these amazing boats at the beginning of what's called the Viking Age. And he also, there was overpopulation in Scandinavia at the time. He wants to find, and he's a farmer. When we first meet him, he's a farmer. And he wants to find good agricultural land for his folk, which is one of the things that did prompt the Viking voyages around the world. And they were also traders, of course. They were on the Silk Road. There's lots of things that have, you know, that people are finding out about them now. Why it's actually struck such a chord, though, I honestly can't tell you. When I was researching, and this is many years ago, the Alfred the Great project, and people asked me what I was doing, I said, I'm working on Alfred the Great and the Vikings. They went, okay, that's interesting, you know. Whenever it was in 2011-12, I told them that I was going to start writing a TV series about Vikings. So, oh my God, really? How fantastic, you know. And then suddenly there were Viking exhibitions in museums all around the world, you know, there was this extraordinarily new, an explosion of interest about Vikings. And I can't account for that, but it's in the zeitgeist.
If we can talk about Ragnar Lothbrok, then the main character in for much of the series, he is a historical character. He has grounding in real historical record. And I know that you looked at the sagas. So perhaps for people who might not be familiar with those sources, could you explain what they were and where you might find Ragnar?
Well, there is a saga of Ragnar Lothbrok. But the truth is that Ragnar is the first great Viking hero to emerge from the mists of myth and legend. There is still some controversy about whether he was real or not. We do, however, know that several of his sons were real, that Bjorn Ironside sailed around the Mediterranean, was chased by Barbary pirates. We know that the leader of the great army went to England to revenge their father's death, was that the leader was Ivar the Boneless, and who wouldn't want to write stories about a character called Ivar the Boneless? My historical advisor and I, Justin Pollard, thought that on balance, Ragnar did exist. His name does occur in several accounts, and of course these accounts would have been written by Christian monks in France and Ireland and England. And his name crops up, and often in different places at the same time or whatever. So there is substantial evidence. And in any case, even if he didn't exist, it was necessary that he did for the story, for my saga that I was going to tell. And it was always going to be the story of Ragnar and his sons. So, I wasn't myself concerned at all that I was going to kill him off, even though I knew that he was very popular, had become a hugely popular character. There was some disquiet amongst some of our American executives, but the most extraordinary thing happened that the episode after he died, the ratings went through the roof. So, but of course, you can imagine that what people thought was, my God, one of the main characters is God. What happens next? You know, what do they make of this? And then we were fortunate that we cast an Australian from a farming family in the outback as Ragnar, you know. Because I didn't believe that, again, we come down to cliches. You know, Vikings were shouty, long-haired, sort of rather grubby, hippie types, you know, who just bludgeoned everyone. And But they were Scandinavians, and it's not my idea of Scandinavians, who I think of, generally speaking, as rather quiet, intelligent, introverted often. And I said, I want that, my Viking hero, to be those, have those qualities, totally to confound absolutely the cliché of what people think of as Viking. And we went down to the wire before we cast Travis. He sent a self-tape in from his kitchen in the outback, in which he didn't pretend to be a Viking, whereas lots of the other self-tapes people go, I am Viking, you know. And he was very quiet, and he spoke with a lot of long pauses, which I was very impressed by. So we back to Hunch, and we cast him. And then we cast Lagatha, because I like training away, but she's a black belt in Taekwondo. And she had to be persuasive. She had to be convincing as a warrior figure.
I'd really like to talk about the character of Lagatha, because I think it's fair to say you got a bit of flack, I think, from people who said, oh, there's no way that women would have been involved in it. They wouldn't have been fighting. They wouldn't have been warriors. But there was a potential discovery last year, which may have vindicated this in some way.
Well, it wasn't a new discovery. This, there's a Viking tomb, which is it's always been regarded as the quintessential Viking warrior, because all his weapons were displayed around him in the grave. And it was just taken for granted. Of course, it was a man, and it's been, I don't know when this was dug up. It could have been 100 years ago, but it's in Scandinavia somewhere. But there was a new curator at the place where he is, lies, and she got rather interested in the hips of the skeleton, and they brought in another woman scientist, actually, who did DNA tests, and lo and behold, he is a she, and she was very definitely a warrior. She must have fought in the Sheerwald. She must have earned herself a huge reputation to be buried in that way. And having, you know, fought for that idea, I suppose I felt very vindicated. I noticed, I don't look at social media on the whole, but people draw my attention to it occasionally. And there were still people posting things like, no, you're still wrong, women aren't strong enough to fight. It was unbelievable. The misogyny that's still out there is just incredible.
And as you've already mentioned, something that drew you to the Vikings was how they treated women in their society. Mm. And what could you explain a little bit more about what you found about women's place in Viking society?
Well, I was, from my original research and reading, I was astonished to find that women could own property, they could divorce their husbands, they could rule, and they could fight and did fight in the Shield Wall with their husbands and brothers, and this idea that they were the attitude towards them was more emancipated than certainly in Anglo-Saxon societies and in French societies of the time was very startling to me, because you know, here is an essentially still Iron Age culture, and you assume that over time people get more cultured. But here we are, you know, that by the time William the Conqueror, who was, you know, descended from our great Rollo, invaded England in 1060, he took away whatever rights women still had in that period, you know, obliterated them. And one has to say, I don't want to be controversial about this, well, I don't mind being, but that after the Viking Age probably lasted about 400 years, and by the end of that period, all Viking societies, all the Scandinavian countries had been Christianized. And unfortunately, it was a feature of Christian society to remove rights from her women.
Well, you mentioned Frankish society there. Mm. And one thing I was very interested to find was that you resurrected a number of dead languages for the show. Can you talk a little bit about that process and how you go about looking at a language that doesn't exist anymore?
Well, we get academics to do it. We get people who are more qualified than we are. And, of course, we started with that the Vikings would have spoken Old Norse. And the Saxons would have spoken Anglo-Saxon, and a lot of other people would have spoken Latin. The church is the language of the church. So we needed, in order to be as authentic as we could be, we needed to hear some of those languages. We didn't want subtitles all the way through, but we wanted to start the first time you met any of these people, they would speak in their own language. And so we, again, it's Justin Pollard, my historical advisor, got in touch with his academic contacts, many of them in Cambridge, I think, linguists and so on, and said, this is what we need translating into Anglo-Saxon, into Old Norse. And the detail that went into it was quite extraordinary. So the academics would sometimes squabble amongst themselves about the regional accents of Anglo-Saxon. So an Anglo-Saxon guy living in the south of England would speak differently still from someone in the north. And then when the Vikings, I think in season 3 of our story, go to Francia, France, and attack Paris, which is, again, a historically recorded event, we wanted to find out what the people in Paris spoke at that time, the Franks. And it turned out that Frankish language is closer to German. It also hasn't been heard for hundreds of years, heard or spoken for hundreds of years. So, you know, the academics had a whale of a time figuring out what that sounded like. And so I think we've resuscitated or helped to resuscitate about 4 or 5 dead languages. And that's been another great journey, actually.
We don't always realise just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger. Talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only, exclusions apply.
So if we can talk about The Real Vikings, which is a documentary which will follow season 4. So why was the need to go deeper?
Well, it wasn't my idea. of course, the History Channel and A&E documentary makers, and that was their principal activity for years. Vikings is their first long-form drama. I was pleased that this was going to happen. Vikings is based on research and it's as authentic as we can make it as a drama. At the same time, I was slightly concerned that perhaps when they started to talk to the really serious people in the world, Scandinavian professors, the archaeologists, the people who really know about Vikings, that perhaps they would show up many of my mistakes and misleading storylines in the show. And so when I was first interviewed for the documentary, I think I probably got over-passionate in my description of what I was trying to do and why I was doing it, and that it was as authentic as we could make it. And I did have a historical advisor, don't you know? And because I think I felt defensive. But actually, joyfully, the documentary has by and large validated the show by taking the cameras to the real sites around England and around Scandinavia. So I relaxed a little bit about that and enjoyed it and took part in some of it. And I do think it's changing people's perceptions, even and especially in Scandinavia, of the Viking Age and what the Vikings were. And so both the show and the documentary are part of that essential rethink of the Vikings and their culture and their gods and their influence on the world. So it's been an entirely positive experience.
If we can talk a little bit more generally, because I know aside from the Vikings, you've obviously written on the Tudors, then later on Elizabeth I, and next you have Mary, Queen of Scots, and projects on the Caesars as well. Perhaps we could talk a little bit about the challenges of balancing historical fact and then fiction. I know you say you take the details and then you walk with them and develop characters from there. So what's your process and what's your feeling about the balance between the two?
Well, everything I write begins life as reading and research. And because I spent, I think, so long in universities, I was in universities for about 12 years, and so the actual research is a major pleasure for me. I enjoy it. I have an open mind when I do that, and I'm waiting for characters and storylines to emerge from the material, helped again by historical advisors, by a friend of mine who is an Icelandic writer who provides a lot of Viking material, Viking detail. And it's a way of trying to construct a saga that so it begins in reality, or perhaps what passes for reality. Historians don't always tell you the truth, because they don't know it. But then I have to compose it into drama, you know, because otherwise no one would watch it. So there have to be storylines, and the storylines have to be exciting enough for people to keep watching. But in that process, it doesn't mean that you can't learn things at the same time. I'm not writing these historically based things to be educational. But if, having watched the shows, it drives people back to the sources and the historical record, that's great. I think that's absolutely fantastic. So I have another thing that's very important to me, is that what I try to do is to connect the past to the present. I always hated those BBC costume dramas because they were about people who had nothing to do with me or my family at all. You know, they dressed in different ways and they spoke about things that weren't particularly interesting. So right from the early days, the early part of my career, especially when I got to Elizabeth, and so I wanted to connect that to, especially to the experience of women, contemporary women. So, for example, Elizabeth, the director, and I thought of her not as an iconic queen, but as a young woman in a really tough space who's inherited her father's business, and there are two other big businesses who want to take over her business. Okay. So that immediately creates some reality. I don't think it then gives you the liberty to tell anything, to say anything. I don't think, you know, I don't like Britannia because it is purportedly to be about the Romans in Britain, and it's nothing at all to do with the Romans in Britain. But I think that my stuff has always got to be tethered in some way to historical reality. But I try very hard to find ways of connecting it to the tissues of contemporary life.
You talk there about seeing Elizabeth as a young woman, which is a guise that we might not have seen her in for a time. And I believe that you might be approaching Julius Caesar in the same way. It was very recently announced that your next project will be with Martin Scorsese and on the Caesars. Mm. So could you explain maybe what you think the popular conception of Julius Caesar is and why you want to challenge that?
Well, I don't think I've ever seen a representation of Caesar on stage or on screen where he isn't a middle-aged guy, a balding middle-aged guy. And I don't know why that is, but I suspect it's because, again, it goes back to that, the fact of nobody being able to connect one culture to the other. So if you're dealing with Romans, they have to be very serious. They have to be different. So Julius Caesar, what a great, iconic figure. He must come over. That's totally serious. And of course, we're always affected by how Shakespeare represented him. But if you actually read the history, if you read Suetonius, it's much more about a young guy who starts off in huge danger and huge jeopardy, and becomes, in due course, the most famous man who ever lived on Earth. And to tell that story is mind-blowing. You know, to even try and begin to tell that story is mind-blowing. But you have to start. I don't want to start with him having achieved something and being a senator and all that, because we think of the Romans as middle-aged guys and patricians and things. No, he was a young guy, like I was a young guy once, but he was in a different context, in a different reality. But he still had lots of stuff that young guys have. You know, he had vigour, he had dreams, he had, he was brave. We're going to concentrate quite a bit on the Caesars as younger people than we've seen them before, with more vitality, carving out an empire.
How do you think that your show, six seasons and going strong, has helped the reputation of Vikings as these marauding plunderers?
Well, I'm happy to say, and I hear that the whole reputation of the Vikings in their home countries in Scandinavia has been transformed, and it must, and I've been told that it's partly due to their representation in Vikings, because obviously at the end of the Viking Age all the Scandinavian countries had been Christianized, and the Christian countries as they then became had a very uneasy feeling, I think, about their heritage, some of their heritage, about the Viking heritage, because why would you want to align yourself with murderers and rapists? But now they feel, I think, liberated to go and reclaim their wonderful heritage and, as boat builders and as pagans and that has happened around the world, isn't it astonishing that, of course, the show is very big in places where you'd expect it to be big, and Germany, Canada, America, wherever. But also in Saudi Arabia. I mean, what that's about, I don't know. But it's great. It's fantastic, and I hope that the general view of Vikings has changed.
And I hope we're not getting too far ahead of viewers who might be on seasons 4 and 5 now, but season 6 takes us to Russia.
Yes.
So what is known about the Vikings in Russia and how they, what their communities were like there?
Russia is called Russia because it was founded by the Rus Vikings, and whose capital was Kiev and Novgorod. And when we go there in the show, it's still a very young kingdom. It's only one generation on from the founding of Rus. But it's a Christian culture. It's not long been a Christian culture, so there are still vestiges of their earlier paganism. It's a slightly more what we might call civilized culture. The decors, the buildings are have been built by better builders than the Scandinavian models, but what it does, we know that the Vikings went to Rus and as they went on the Silk Road. But what it does for the show is revitalize the show. We take the show to new places. We know the Vikings went there. We take the show there. So we're doing new builds. We're building new sets. We're casting new actors. It just lifts everyone. It's a wonderful tonic for everyone to take them to. So now we have Kiev on the back lot. As last season we had York, the city of York, and the amount of work that goes into those kind of constructions is absolutely amazing, staggering. It looks wonderful.
And will we see the Vikings get to America?
We have to wait and see.
That was Michael Hurst. The Real Vikings documentary series is currently airing on Tuesday evenings on History UK, following episodes of Vikings Season 4. And the second half of Vikings Season 5 will be available for viewers on Amazon later in 2018. Okay, so that's about it for today, but please do join us on Monday when we'll be talking about Ruth Ellis, the last woman to be executed in Britain.
Thanks for listening to this History Extra podcast, which was produced by Jack Fletcher. Do let us know what you think about this episode by emailing podcast@historyextra.com, and we might read out your messages in future editions. Alternatively, why not keep in touch via Twitter or Facebook, where you'll find us at History Extra. For more great history content, don't forget to visit our website, historyextra.com, which is full of history articles, quizzes, image galleries, and more. Plus, it's where you can download hundreds of previous episodes of this podcast.